hppodcraft.com.
There is death in the clouds, there is fear in the night. For the dead in their shrouds hail the sun's turning flight and chant wild in the woods as they dance round a Yule altar, fungus and white. H.P. Lovecraft. December's icy fingers wound around Richard Whitson, tendrils of a cold-blooded thing probing for any opening in his coat. Somewhere distant, carolers weakly defied the weather with a feeble warmth of song. He crossed the nearly deserted depot parking lot, hunching in his sweater and overcoat like a tortoise in its shell, and boarded the bus for Sesqua Valley. The vehicle hesitated for a moment, as if expecting other riders, then lurched forward in departure.
That was the intro paragraph to William H. Pugmire's and Jessica Amanda Salmonson's Oh Christmas Tree, a story we're covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon, where we bring you Halloween in July and Christmas in August, because the rest of the time hurts like it's New Year's Day. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and that reader was our good friend and boon companion, Andrew Lehman.
The original. Still unable to hang out with Lehman, unfortunately, but we can hear his voice, which is 50% as good, maybe 30%. They've always got new things on offer over at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, but I'm going to say if you were ever nervous about investing in Masks of Nyarlathotep, maybe because of the length of that project, pick that up now. It's hours and hours of not what's going on, and I have been enjoying that ride. Like, man, I want some not now right now. that's some very good not now. Just as I've been enjoying our trip through Lovecraft country this month.
Pretty sure this is the first time we've covered a story by a fan of our show.
Right.
Willem was not only a listener, he was a subscriber.
Yeah, he helped us out early on, too. Made some supportive videos telling people to listen to the show. And I had a little bit of an email friendship with him. I was just scanning back over that, and as you say, he was a subscriber because most of our interactions were based on tech support issues, which is strange. At first, we had some little tangential discussions about 70s punk rock, which he knows everything about. I was a little late getting back to him on something once, and then when I did, he said, oh, good, I was worried that my oldie-timey writing was driving you off. Because he was saying, I'm a little extra. He didn't use those exact words, but...
No.
I said, no way, I love it, just as I love the writing in this story. His emails were like that, just kind of beautiful and nice.
Yeah,
I liked him.
I saw him in Necronomicon a few times, but I never honestly got the courage to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because he's a big deal in the Lovecraft scene, very well liked by everybody I've ever talked to. I've never heard a bad word about him. And the shame of it all, the real reason I never talked to him is because I never read any of his stuff. But I have now.
You have now. I know. I wish I'd dug into this back then because I really like it.
Yeah.
It surprised me. I don't know why. I didn't have low expectations necessarily, but I didn't think I would like it as much as I do, which I don't have no idea why. But I guess just because it's modern and I always kind of think, well, that's not going to be as good. But this stuff is.
Yeah.
He's a very talented guy. While we've read a lot of Lovecraftian fiction that gets the world building stuff right, his pieces, or at least this, that it really does the atmosphere right. I think in terms of writing in that style, it can just come off as so imitative normally, and he seems to do it well without it being an imitation. I believe it. And I think this story is a really good example of that.
And I also think that he adds a lot more to it than just being a Lovecraft pastiche. I mean, there's definitely his own voice in there. And it's got another level that Lovecraft stuff doesn't have, in my opinion. But
well, you know, it's funny, though. I just want to say, I wouldn't have admitted it, but I guess it's true. I didn't really talk to him at those events because I was nervous as well.
Oh, yeah?
I remember he was at a panel, and I was like, I could wait till this is over and come up and introduce myself. And then I thought, oh, I've got a flight to catch. I can't do that. But I could have done it. I just was a little embarrassed, I guess.
Yeah.
That's good to hear you say that. But I regret it now.
I deeply regret it now. And that's life. You make stupid choices sometimes, and you don't really think about it. And of course he would have been nice, and he would have been awesome. Yeah. And I just blew it because I was being chicken. So lame. But some bio on Willem Hopfrog Pugmire. He was born in 1951, just a few years younger than my father. He was born in 49. He was born to a Mormon father and a Jewish mother in Seattle. He was a Mormon missionary in Northern Ireland when he was young. But while there, he started a correspondence with Robert Bloch.
Good thinking.
In 1973, he returned from his mission and he came out as gay to the church and his family. They gave him psychiatric treatments, which I imagine must have been terrible in 1973 for that. And then he was excommunicated from the church. He came back to the church after the death of his longtime partner in 1995. He told the church leadership that he was a queer Mormon, but would remain celibate. He described himself as an eccentric recluse, the queen of eldritch horror, and a punk rock queen and street transvestite.
Definitely an outsider. Although, you know, to me, when I learned about him, I thought, oh, cool, here's someone I can relate to, kind of.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's not really a joke. I mean, there's a lot of very intelligent people in the Lovecraft community. I feel a little deficient sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not that educated. But somebody who was a little on the punk rock side of it, I thought, that's a little more where I am in this spectrum.
Your speed.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he started writing at an early age, but he became discouraged, and he didn't really pick it up again until doing a punk rock zine in 1981 called Punk Lust.
I miss the zines. That's what we'd be doing if this were the 80s. You know, H.P. Oh, Punkcraft yeah. would be zines and tape drops and...
Yeah,
it's all going to be in my alternate reality story, HP Podcraft Neon Nights.
Whoa,
yeah.
Sign me up. His heavy Lovecraftian stuff is set in his own version of Arkham Country called Sesqua Valley. It's in the American Northwest. And this story is from 1989 and was published in Tales by Moonlight 2. And it was co-authored by Jessica Amanda Salmonson.
Yeah, it seems like it's a real even collaboration. He details it in the afterword, so we'll talk about that at the end of the show.
This version is from his collection, Tales of Sesqua Valley, which came out in 1997.
And my hope is that people will be intrigued if they haven't dug into his stuff and go pick up that collection. This is the first story in it. Unfortunately, Willen passed away in 2019, but has achieved immortality through his work. So let's get into it.
The story begins right around Christmas time as our protagonist, Richard, is coming to the Sesqua Valley, riding on a quiet bus. He drifts between sleep and awakeness, giving it a very dreamlike quality.
Although the heaters allowed a modicum of comfort, loneliness persisted, a sort of melancholy that had been increasing with the approach of Christmas. The language gives you some sense of the main character. It's also not first person, so we don't have to accept that this is the way this person thinks or speaks. Or
yeah.
It helps the language suggest things about his character without it being improbable. Mm-hmm. He's a little out of place in the modern world, but again, it's not excessive or cloying. It's a purple prose, but somehow not too purple. I don't know how to express it. It made me relate to him and like him, and the bus finally it pulls into Sesqua Valley. Above thick evergreens, silhouetted by a vast scarlet sunset, mountains rose in awesome magnificence. Particularly striking were two jagged peaks like wings folded on some gigantic demon's shoulders. The majesty of Sesqua Valley was dizzying. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then we get some of that out-of-time sentiment when he peeps a big, run-down, century-old mansion. It says, it was certainly a place to cherish in this sad age, when houses rarely last their young owners the time it takes to pay a mortgage.
Mm. We discover that his father has recently passed away and left him with a nice inheritance, allowing him to start a new life anywhere he wants, and he considers maybe buying that old mansion.
He has no family, no job worth saving back in the city, and we're finding him in this sad place, but it's a hopeful place as well.
We also discover that his father is from this valley, and that his estranged grandfather is still alive and living here.
Estranged and also a stranger. He didn't even know that the grandfather existed.
Yeah.
It said, after the lonely despair of the last 2 years and after his father's wasting agony, the discovery that his grandfather lived took on an importance of an inordinate proportion. So maybe he had been told a story that he was dead. I think he knew that he had a grandfather of some sort.
Well, sure.
Yeah, but the fact that he was around and he could talk to him, no idea.
So the bus finally pulls into the Sesqua Depot, which is just a sign by the general store / post office. Richard is met by an old man in an overcoat with a cap and white beard, whom he recognizes from a picture his father had to be his grandfather, Nathan Whitson. He greets Richard with a handshake and says that he looks just like his father. They get into his old pickup truck and drive to his cottage in the woods by the lake. The old gentleman asked after news that betrayed an appalling ignorance of life outside the valley. Richard instantly adored the gentle-mannered oldster and felt that shadow drawn out of his heart. Why, he even found occasion to laugh. The next morning, Nathan explains to his grandson that Richard's father never liked Sesqua Valley.
This is an old town, Nathan says. Families have lived here for numerous generations. Pioneers considered it their stroke of luck, discovering this fertile valley somehow never claimed by the Indians, who elsewhere were peaceful competitors, but still competitors. None questioned this fortune. None asked why Indians shunned a place abundant with game and rich of soil. They just settled in, and it is mostly those same old families who reside on this land. I liked that hinting of the natural here.
Mm-hmm. Nathan explains that he tried city life, met a woman, and had a child. But after she died, when his son was only 8 years old, he returned to the valley. He feels he has psychic ties to the place, and he's happy that Richard returned, saying, "I feared the Whitson line would die out of Sesquoth with my passing." Richard discovers his grandfather's study, and he finds old pictures of his father as a boy and his grandmother, and of course it's full of books. Books dealt with such wildly varied topics as North American Indian lore, European and Chinese mythology, archaeology, regional history, and the histories of Puget Sound and the near Pacific, including, it appeared, some carefully bound original manuscripts regarding early Northwest expeditions.
So no mysterious cults or Necronomicons, thank you very much. Glad to see a book collection in here that doesn't have this crazy range of titles. This is all about the atmosphere of the Pacific Northwest, which has atmosphere in spades.
Yeah.
And that's what all of the books are kind of dealing. I love that area. Twin Peaks, The Ring, The Changeling. It's such a great spot for supernatural horror. Love the overcast, woodsy look of it. It's awesome.
He goes on to say that many were in French and Spanish medieval script and look centuries old. His grandfather notices the books that he's looking at and chuckles, saying poor Maurice de Roux was an explorer of the region 10 years before Lewis and Clark, but he never found any fame due maybe to his writing style.
And possibly due to his writing content, because it's all a little insane. He says this imaginative chronicle of his explorations was sent to the king, but the king had actually been guillotined a year before receiving it, so yeah. Return of post. Nathan, it came back. Somehow Nathan's managed to acquire it. Since historians don't want it, they think it's all craziness.
Nathan reads from the book, translating to English.
"I have come, my cherished and honored king, to a land that makes all the grim occurrences in the Black Forest mere fairy tales passed on by frightened spinsters. There are trees whose sap is blood, and toads with the faces of men, pixies with poisonous fangs, and faceless devils that fly silently through the night. There is evidence of all this and other abhorrent truths, for much have I seen with my own eyes. There is an Aborigine legend that you would not find difficult to believe if you could but feel the air of this unwholesome place. Two titanic demons, say the natives, met in battle on this unhallowed ground. The red demon was of goodwill. The white would enslave all humanity. The white demon unleashed all manner of odious beings upon his foe, and still the white was overcome and turned to stone. The demon-turned-stone the Aborigines called Celta, and it is a strange sight to see, a mountain which lends credence to the legend. Yet, as the story goes, the red titan could not entirely banish the minions of the white, for they thrive in good proportion and await the day of their master's return from his stone prison. All this is to inform your most gracious majesty that such a land is not fit for French dominion."
What a great way to reference the mythos. You know, not abusing us with long names that nobody asks questions about. Like, yeah. The aquarium, yeah, is just a version that's passed through the myths of the region. So we have that god is sleeping and might return when the monsters ask it to. But it doesn't seem incredible.
Richard says, "What would Christmas be without a scary story?" But his grandfather doesn't seem to find any humor in that. He explains they celebrate Yule differently in the valley. They don't exchange gifts, and we don't succumb to the crass commercialism of wasted electricity on injured trees. I do. I succumb like crazy.
Well, you should be careful, because I was actually just reading that. Do you have an artificial tree?
We have an artificial tree, yeah.
Good, good. Because I was reading this thing that people that go out and cut them down, they'll, you know, get the Christmas tree and drag it home. But at night, thieves are hiding in the tree. They climb out, steal your stuff, clean the place out. So get the artificial ones.
Oh, golly.
Those schemers never stop thinking.
They never stop. Richard drops the topic of the Christmas tree, but he still feels like he needs one, you know, for the holidays. Even though it's not a local tradition, he wants a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
Later that day, Richard finds some boxed up Christmas decorations and decides that he's going to bring Christmas to the Sesqua Valley, or at least his uncle.
I feel like somebody was overly aggressive with their holiday cheer to Willem. You know, everybody needs a little Christmas fun. He says, "Oh, yeah, let me give you an example of that going wrong." There was also this section. That afternoon, he explored the good-sized cottage. It was not big, but spacious enough for one old man. In the cramped attic, he found what he had secretly been searching for, a box containing Christmas candles, bulbs, and tinsel. That was something we forgot to mention in the aquarium. Oftentimes, the size of a place was measured in old men back in the day. So in that story, it said, you know, her house had one conservatory, one aquarium, and was spacious enough for 16 old men. That's what it said in the ad. We forgot to mention that. And here, you know exactly how big it is. It's spacious enough for one old man.
The week before Christmas, Richard is out exploring with his grandfather. It's getting very cold, so cold that Nathan says that the squirrels are hibernating.
Yeah, that's the reason he's giving. I mean, there's no wildlife. Richard notices this. The sounds are so absent that it's noticeable.
It's just the weather.
Sure.
That's all it is. Richard goes off on his own and finds a little grove with a circle of mushrooms and a brilliantly colored red spruce, half again as tall as Richard. A perfect, squat, widely branched, sturdy conifer. Richard was entirely unfamiliar with the type.
I thought of it like it's a little baby heart tree from Game of Thrones. Kind of had that feel to me.
Oh, yeah.
The little clearing with the tree in the middle with the red leaves.
His grandfather finds him and sternly asks what he's doing there. And Richard explains, I just got a bit lost. And his grandfather just kind of gives him a look and says, okay, we should get back.
It's the first time we've seen him get a little edgy instead of being totally pleasant.
Later, Richard goes into town and sees it's very small, with most of the shops boarded up. There's only a herb shop and a small bookstore, as well as the general store slash post office, which also is a gas station. Dusk comes quickly, and the shops close up. Richard notices the old mansion again and decides to sneak in and have a look-see. It's very worn down and has the odd smell of a goat's den.
That was very good and specific. Although, I couldn't help wondering when I read that, well, how many goats does it smell like? You know? Because usually we get told, is it 10,000 goats? 7 goats? Got to be specific on quantities, young writers. That's rule number one.
Yeah, very specific on the goat smell quotient.
Well, you know, 10,000 alligators in that other story.
Exactly.
Totally got it right away. Yeah. Here, he just says it smells like a goat's den. Goat's high rise? Goat's yurt? I mean, which?
Yeah, come on. The furniture is in good shape, but the books in the library are all moldy with damp. A volume of violet catches his attention, but the ink is too smeared and faded to read. Looking out one of the broken windows, Richard notices a campfire in the distance. It's hard to see, but it seems like there are children dancing around the fire. He then thinks that it seems like the children are naked. And then there's some kind of sing-song going along, there's some kind of chanting. It all seems odd, and he thinks that they're not children at all. But then they stop dancing and singing, and this freaks him out so much that he hides. And then when he peeps back out, the fire's gone.
That scene was legit scary.
Yeah.
It's freezing cold outside, and he sees these naked kids dancing around. It seems like they stop when they see him looking at them. And there's no way they should be able to, because the distance is great, right?
Yeah.
So that's when he hides. And then when he looks again, no fire, no kids, can't see a thing. The whole place is dark, just a pitch black manor. Nobody wants to be caught up in the middle of something like that. But, oh man, it got me though. It really was effective. Oh man, are they coming?
Well, he thinks he sees some kind of shape near the base of the tree next to the house, and then he just hauls ass out of there.
Yeah, a limb stretching toward his window cracked so very slightly. Yeah, they're out there creeping.
Out of the house and back to his grandfather's cottage, he doesn't sleep that night. The next day, in the study at his grandfather's place, he finds a copy of that same violet book, but this one is in good condition. It's called Visions of Croydon by William Davis Manley, Sesqua Valley Press, 1955.
I read that as Visions of Dan Aykroyd. That's what it was in my head. I wonder if the Manley author is a nod to Manley Wade Wellman. Probably.
I would think so. In faded purple ink had been penned a simple inscription to Nathan, my fellow dreamer, on the night side, with fond best wishes, Manley.
He came upon a sonnet about children of the valley who danced within a ring of stones. The simple line drawing that accompanied the poem caused a chill to kiss the length of his spine. It spewed a group of curious, shaggy dwarf-like creatures dancing within a circle of standing stones. Their indistinct faces were oddly bestial. Dancing with them was a woman of normal stature, yet her face too wore an aspect of their non-humanity.
Richard asks his grandfather if he knows anything about the author, and Nathan's a bit dodgy. Richard then mentions that he saw children dancing around the fire last night, and this causes Nathan to drop the book. He then plays it off like, it's no big thing, kids dance. Richard says, yes, but they were naked. Ice around the lake and children are dancing naked in the night? And Nathan says, perhaps it was an illusion of reflected firelight. They might actually have been well clothed. And then Richard pauses and says, did I mention a fire?
I like Nathan's tactic, though. Naked, huh? Have you considered that they might have been the opposite of naked? Maybe all you were seeing was just a bunch of clothes. It's really that's not even like, oh, it was just the wind. That's more like, I think I heard a ghost. Maybe you were just not hearing a ghost. Well, it's not even an explanation.
No.
I guess he says maybe it was a trick of the firelight on there.
Yeah, remember they had flesh-colored clothing.
Yes.
So Richard begs him to tell him what the heck is going on. Why is he hiding things? Is he afraid he'll return to the city and leave the valley? But Nathan, he just kind of keeps mum, and he says, well, you know, the local legends are popular around here, and kids will sometimes act them out.
It says Richard felt an idiot. Until that moment, he thought his grandfather was revealing some legitimate, incredible horror. But it was merely child's play. So, you know, he buys into it, as I would, too.
Well, of course.
And also, people do that polar plunge thing every year. You got the ice bucket challenge. You know, right, I think he could just think this is something like that. It's a cult ritual challenge. These kids are just going out in the cold on a dare.
So that night, Richard sneaks out of the cottage to go chop down that reddish-hued evergreen.
Wearing his bad idea jeans. Says soon he knelt before the blood-red tree, saw how it almost glistened in cold winter moonlight. That lunar sphere was high, drenching the valley with eerie illumination. The white mountains sparkled. Very serene. Mm-hmm. And then, one great little sentence, he severed the tree at its base.
And somehow the valley darkened, and something atop the mountain wailed in a woe. Now, while his grandfather's in the study, Richard sets up the tree, decorates it, and he's about to place the glass star on the top when his grandfather comes in horrified and says, what have you done?
I had a similar thing the other day. I made some bacon, and I set it aside for BLTs later in the day. Took a nap. While I was asleep, Heather ate all the bacon.
Oh, Heather!
Same reaction. What have you done? Even more dramatic than this.
So Grandpa's freaking out. He says, you're an outsider. You couldn't have known. And he gets his rifle, saying under his breath that this won't stop them. Richard asks, Gramps, are you sleepwalking? Because you're acting really weird. And then Nathan goes, oh, yeah, that's it. I'm sleepwalking. Oh, I'm awake now. You should probably go to bed. It's really late. Good night. So Richard does. And he goes in and he could hear his grandfather moving around in the cottage doing stuff. As he lies there, he falls asleep and then he's awakened by shouts. He hears something breaking into the cottage and he hears, get out, get out. It's his grandfather. Richard tries to open his door, but it's locked from the outside. And he tries to bust down the door, but he freezes when he hears gunfire and an unholy shrieking.
Whatever made that cry, it was no beast he knew. Presumably not even one goat here. With a cowardice that would haunt him all his life, Richard sank to the floor and listened through the night. His grandsire's shouting became a scream that ended in a frothy gurgle.
Oh, man. Richard curled up and hid as he heard tiny dancing feet prancing around the house and a creepy childlike voices chanting.
It's a little like when I'll stay with a family that has young kids. You know, sometimes there's that early morning period where the kids are up, but the parents are still asleep. And you're like, I can't go out there. This is the time when the children rule. What bizarre traditions they'll have.
It's true.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
They're my kids and I still hide. Richard hid and he cried and remained quiet until the sun came up and then the creatures left the house. He pries open the door and looks upon the aftermath.
The room was in shambles, the kitchen window broken inward. Blood smeared the walls and floor. He went to the sink below the broken window, glass splintering into his naked feet, and looked toward the hunched mountains. Against the violet of beautiful dawn, the silhouette of some great winged creature was plain above the lake. It let loose the torso clutched by talons. Richard watched the corpse that fell and upset the icy stillness of lake water. Richard turned from the impossible sight and fought the urge to retch. He stumbled like a man blinded by his terror back into the living room, there to gaze once more at the product of his crime, that once beautiful Christmas tree. It was now a ghastly sight. The blood-stained bark had mottled and grown white with leprous disease. The dead, withered branches bent to the crimson-spattered floor. But it was as he looked at the tree's topmost bough that he lost the battle to keep his stomach. For where would have been a beautiful glass star, rested a blood-drenched human heart.
Bam.
I gotta say, I really love the story and I'm gonna read more of his stuff. It's great. However, I think it is a bridge too far in that last sentence.
Yeah.
Having the heart in the tree, it's a little too gory. It didn't need to be there. I felt like any implication of him looking at that tree and then losing his lunch, and then that would just be the end of the story. And it's like, well, what did he see? What was on that tree, you know? And then the fact that he just says, oh, yeah, it was a human heart up where the star would be. It's like, eh, didn't need it.
Yeah, it's a little bit bridge too far. I mean, it's a little like, what's the slasher movie we talk about where they open the door and the pizza delivery guy's out there, but then his head just falls off?
I don't remember.
Great effect. Yeah. But at some point you go, well, wait a minute. So the killer chopped off his head, put it back on, somehow got the guy to stand up. You know, things start.
Well, I mean, they were up. The little demons were around all night doing stuff, so they could have done it.
Look, this guy stole their tree and ripped it down, and who knows what significance that tree had, or you know, the mountain itself groaned when he did that. So it is a warning. You know, here you go. Here's a heart.
I just felt the subtlety of this whole story was great. It was perfect. It just had that perfect balance that I love in a weird tale.
So you would have preferred it if, like, the tree came to life and they wrestled.
Exactly. Subtle. In the collection of stories, there's an afterword on this. So we have what the author actually said about his own story, which we don't have very often in this thing. So,
yeah, it says, this was the first Sesqua Valley story that I wrote when I invented the valley in 1974. I had recalled August Derleth telling Ramsey Campbell that rather than setting his Lovecraftian tales in HPL's New England, invent a region of his own homeland, and this seemed excellent advice. As a kid, I always spent 2 weeks of every summer with my cousins in North Bend and was captivated by Mount Si. When I created my own Lovecraftian set place, I knew it would be a haunted version of North Bend. Imagine my delight when the television show Twin Peaks shows the same locale over a decade later as the inspiration for their Uncanny series. Those early stories were very poor, and the original version of Oak Christmas Tree was rejected by Space and Time. Which is a magazine. Like, Space and Time did not reject the story. I let Jessica read the story, and she surprised me by completely rewriting it. The new version was accepted and later published in Jessica's paperback horror anthology from Tor, Tales by Moonlight 2. That version was mostly the work of Jessica, and so I have extensively revised it for this edition, adding my own voice and melding the story with how the valley has changed and solidified my imagination over the decades. It's a pretty cool, creepy tale, I think. I agree.
I totally agree.
And so it sounds like it just got batted back and forth, and there's a couple versions of it out there. But but I really liked it, and good job, Jessica, as well.
I'm looking forward to reading more Pugmire stuff, and hopefully you guys like it too out there. So let us know.
I want to thank Andrew Lehman once again for reading on this episode. Always great to have him back, and I hope we're going to be hearing more from him soon.
Me too. I always want more Andrew Lehman in my life.
Don't forget to go to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society and get some stuff to pass the time. There's a lot of it there, and it's all good. This would also be a good time to dive into that full edition of all of the Lovecraft audio readings.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, they're all great. It's Andrew and Sean, and there's no repeats. So if it's a story that they've done, Sean does it, because Andrew read a bunch of the stories for our show.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't get it repeats. It's a new version of it.
Exactly.
It's exciting.
I also want to thank some of our patrons.
Me too. I'd like to thank James Barrett.
I'd like to thank Cheryl R. Hayes.
Brendan McKay, thank you.
Andrew Brown, thank you so much.
Gray Cat, thank you so much.
Matthew Zenher, thank you.
I'd like to thank Albert Hernandez.
Jared Blackman, thank you so much.
David O'Brien, thank you so much.
And Bailey Todd, thank you. We're going to be back with more Lovecraft Madness next week. We haven't exactly picked the story yet. I think we're lingering around around some Green Abyss story, so it'll be a good one. Keep tuning in, and we'll have that for you. For now, this is all we've got. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.